There's the music. Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And Brad Coach is my guest once again. He was on the end of April, and he'll be on again the end of September. We have Brad regularly on the show, and I'm so glad. Hello, Brad. Yes, Brad is calling from, your regular listeners know that Brad is a divorce attorney in Honolulu, and his firm is the biggest divorce firm in Hawaii, and you've been doing this a lot of years. Just give the listeners a little bit of, the new listeners, others will know you, because you're a very frequent guest, I think my most frequent, and I've known you since 1999, and you were on my show in Hawaii that went for over 5 years many times. Anyway, we're friends. Describe your work in Hawaii and why today's topic perhaps will be a threat. I was thinking about this, a threat to your divorce.
My own business.
Your own business.
Yeah.
Because we are going to talk about social media trends that impact modern relationships and marriages and all of that. So, but tell our listeners about your firm in Hawaii and what you do.
Well, I run a firm for like the last 40 years. I run a firm called Coates Fry, Tanimoto, and Gibson, and it's the biggest divorce firm in Hawaii. And it's a weird thing to have made your life's work, but we've probably handled the firm's probably handled maybe 35,000 divorces over the last several decades, and I myself have probably handled about 8,000 or 9,000 of them. So I have more than a passing familiarity with the way romantic life in America is developing or dissolving or whatever you want to call it. I mean, divorce lawyers may soon be about as rare as buggy whip manufacturers or elevator operators or some other outmoded profession, because There's so fewer people getting married nowadays that it may be that there will be a lot. Well, not maybe. It definitely will. There be fewer divorces as we go forward, because you need the people to get married in order to get them divorced. And instead, marriage is going to be replaced by all kinds of other, much more evolving and maybe loosey goosey kinds of relationships that are going to be springing up. And we can talk about several of them today, because these are the social mega trends that are going to impact modern romantic relationships, for sure.
For sure. And I also want to mention, for any new listeners to this program with you, that you have written a book, Divorce with Decency, now in its fifth edition. And it has a lot in it about sociological trends, and that's actually what Brad Coates and I are going to be talking about today.
I forgot to mention my book, either because I'm just getting too old and forgetful, or because maybe I'm too modest or something. But yeah, Divorce with Decency is a great book that talks about all aspects of romantic relationships in society as we know it. So good book to read if you're even if you're just curious about how relationships progress or regress or digress or whatever. But certainly, if anybody's ever going through a divorce or knows somebody who is, it's a very useful book, and it's available on Amazon. And like you say, it's in its fifth edition now. I've been writing and rewriting that crazy book for, 20 years now.
And in the process, I think you have sharpened your sociological expertise. You wear your sociologist hat a little more, looking at trends and all of that, getting out of the per se divorce lawyer persona.
Well, yeah, I mean, after, like I say, about 8,000 divorces, it's you kind of want to move on to something that's a little more than just the meat axe down the middle that divorce lawyers are known for, and it kind of gets more interesting to analyze the psychology or the sociology or the demographics behind, what makes people act the way they do in relationships. And that's become, something I'm probably more known for and lecture about and have TV appearances and stuff like that here in Hawaii. So it is a fascinating subject. It is changing society before our faces. I mean, like I say, when I've rewritten Divorce with Decency 5 times, it's not because the law has changed all that dramatically. There have been, you know, some changes. I mean, we didn't have, you know, gay marriage when I first started writing this book, that's for sure. So there are aspects that have changed, but mainly it's society that's changed, not the law that's changed. And society has dramatically, unwound largely due to social media and several other trends that are going on that we'll be talking about today.
Yes. You prompted a side question. Have you handled any gay divorces?
Oh, yeah,
Lesbian divorces or male partners?
And we've done quite a few of them.
Tell me about that. Tell us about that.
Well, for a while there, I think it may have slowed down a little bit, but homosexual marriage was or gay partnerships were first allowed, that element of society, the gays and lesbians in society were thrilled to have this door opened up to them. And while heterosexual marriages were on the decline, gay marriages, at least initially experienced quite an uptick because there was pent up demand. There were people, gay couples that had been waiting for decades to be able to do something, official with their relationship, and they flocked to it. Now that it's just become a little bit more of the norm and people realize that maybe marriage isn't cracked up to be all that it's cracked up to be, either homosexual or heterosexual, I think it's slowing down a little bit. But for a while, we had those cases coming into our office all the time. And, you know, and when gays get married, they get divorced same as anybody else. Marriages are hard to sustain in modern day society.
They are. And I find that when I do sex therapy and relationship counseling with homosexual couples, it's basically the same as with heterosexual couples, so there's some parallels there. I have to sometimes adjust my homework assignments to accommodate different anatomies, or the same anatomies. But other than that, same kinds of problems, same. Human beings are human beings, and I feel like it's really sad when people are so discriminatory about gays. So that's interesting. But a little aside, so let's get to the topic of the day, which is there are some, and your description is shocking, social mega trends. And these trends impact modern romantic relationships. And let's just jump into this, Brad, about the internet, how it's changed things.
Well, I think the internet and social media has got to be, I mean, it's probably one of the major change agents in society, in Western societies and worldwide societies, everywhere. Obviously, the internet and social media are huge, but the single biggest aspect has been that it's totally upended traditional approaches to romance. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm in my late 60s now, and it used to be when if you wanted to meet or much less marry somebody, you had to physically meet them somewhere. You met them at a bar or the favorite was meeting the bride. The groomsmen met the bridesmaids at the wedding receptions. Those kind of things, you had to meet somebody and live and in person. And the timing had to be right in that person's life. I mean, they both had to be single or looking or whatever. And so those were really the two pillars of relationship building was physical. Physical proximity, physically meeting somebody, and the timing, that everybody was in the right frame of mind or the right marital status or whatever, or non-marital status at the same time. Basically, both those pillars have been totally upended because online dating has meant that proximity is now worldwide and the timing is immediate. You just go online and you meet somebody whenever you want.
Proximity and and timing, totally upended. And I think it's interesting. This is a recent statistic. Today, an estimated one-third of marrying couples in the U.S. met online.
Wow.
And
yeah, that's probably about right.
Yeah, this is a very recent statistic. And as many as 15% of American adults have used dating sites or apps. And do you remember hearing it at all that I do, but that Martha Stewart, and in 2013, she admitted that she had a Match profile, and she was looking for a lover of animals, grandchildren, and the outdoors. And perhaps Martha should have considered Raya, R-A-Y-A, which is a private celebrity dating app. They even have that now. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I've got friends here that are on some millionaire's dating site where you have to qualify to be certified that you're over $1 million in net worth to go on this site. I guess they really segmented the market, that's for sure.
Segmented the market, and then I would think that the guy might have to worry, perhaps, that the woman that seeks him might be a gold digger.
Well, I think, you know, on this one, I think she's got to be certified too. I'm not on any of these sites, so I'm no expert on them. But I can tell you what is happening, and that is, it is segmenting the marrying or the dating populace. I know of sites. I've got friends who have got kids. You know, they're in Ivy League schools, and they can go on sites where they just find other Ivy Leaguers. They can find other, you know, other aristocrats. They can find other college graduates. They don't have to mess with the lower classes anymore. They go right to somebody that they see as their equal. They can find somebody that's a high earner, that's an overachiever, that's, you know, has the right pedigree. And that's cute, I guess, if you want an elitist society, but that's different than, you know, and again, maybe my old school chauvinism is showing, but when I first started as a lawyer, it was not at all uncommon for a senior partner in a law firm to fall in love with a beautiful young secretary who, you know, maybe hadn't been to beyond high school and hadn't anywhere near the pedigree that this silk stocking lawyer had, and yet she was perky and they got along great, and the next thing you know, you're bridging the gap between the classes now. What's happening is the upper class, the college educated, they're marrying one another. Their marriages are more likely to stay together. The most divorce prone element of society is the quote lower classes, the people that have not been, you know, gotten beyond high school or amassed large amounts of money. You know, money's one of the great things to fight about in marriage. So if you haven't got a lot of money, you know, you're likely to be headed for divorce. And if you got married too young, you're likely to be headed for divorce. And if you had kids too young, and all these kind of things that maybe some of the lower end of the quote lower end, I don't want to sound like I say pejorative here, but, you know, of society, you know, they've got more issues. And now the upper end is able to avoid all that and just find one another, and it's causing an even deeper chasm between the haves and the have-nots in society.
I'm going to quote Helen Fisher, Dr. Helen Fisher. She is a biological anthropologist and a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and chief scientific advisor to Match.com. And here's her quote. It's more possible to find someone now than at probably any other time in history, particularly if you're older. You don't have to stand in a bar and wait for the right one to come along. And we've found that people looking for a sweetheart on the internet are more likely to have full-time employment and higher education and to be seeking a long-term partner. So you may get that, too, on any of these sites.
Well, not surprisingly, Dr. Helen Fisher, who I've always had a lot of respect for, she is really one of the gurus. She puts it much more eloquently than what I was trying to say, but that's exactly right. You can just self-select, without having to go with the random chance approach to life. You now just self-select everything you want off of the internet. It works out great for some people, but it is creating a bit of a chasm for those that are left behind.
Yes. Before we leave the online dating, though, I would like to tell you a little bit more about what Helen Fisher observes and suggests. She says, meet 9 people, that our brains are best equipped to handle 5 to 9 options anymore, and we go into cognitive overload. Have you ever experienced that, Brad? Cognitive overload?
Every morning
probably
when I get
not.
Up, yeah.
Okay. And she says, at that point, you just start looking for reasons to say no. Like, look at his ugly shoes. So she says, pick 9, meet in person, then take a break while you get to know at least 1. And I'm going to give you, just as we continue to run the numbers, just 2 more suggestions that she spoke about. And so the first one is meet 9 people, right? The second one is set 3 deal breakers. If there's something you just can't tolerate, smoking, for instance, we're talking tobacco here. Okay, I give clients a limit. But most people focus on wants. They want hot, funny, and you find the right one when you focus on needs. Needs, communication, mutual respect. And then the final point, as far as running the numbers, is give it 3 dates. Even if you, I like this one a lot. Even if you don't feel chemistry doesn't last. Attraction is important, but if someone meets your needs, you may find attraction follows. I think that's often true. Not always, but to give it a little time. A lot of people are not patient enough.
I know several marriage counselor friends, a couple in particular, that's their bottom line, is that love is not hotness or attraction or whatever. It's when two people meet one another's needs. Pretty simple.
Yes.
Although I don't know, I don't like to discount hotness and attraction either. But and I'm sure.
Oh no, you
can't
discount.
I'm sure
that.
You don't.
No, you can't discount that. But you know, there is a. This kind of ties into codependence, but I'd like to describe the difference between want and need is, you know, if you're really interested in somebody and you've been together, you need to be able to look at that person and say, I want you even more than I need you. In fact, I can live without you, but you know what? I can live better with you. So that's the truth. But we do need to have mostly wants and then kind of not codependent needs, but interdependent needs met. That's my take on it anyway.
I think that's right on.
Yeah. The years, the 39 years I've been doing this work, couples counseling, individual counseling, I've seen thousands and thousands of clients. And we were going to get into this. Maybe this is a good segue. That the internet, you write, the internet has had a huge impact on relationships and marriage. But it's made cheating even easier than before. It has also made getting caught easier. And why don't you expand on this before I give some clients, they're very anonymous, of course. But I'll give you client examples of where that's happened.
Well, I'm sure both you and I have had all kinds of clients, anonymous or otherwise, for whom this has been exactly the case. The cheating part is you know quite obvious. We all remember the Ashley Madison site that was exposed, where it was literally designed for married couples to go on and cheat supposedly and anonymously, and then it turned out to not be so anonymous when somebody divulged it all. But certainly, the fact that you can go online on, you know, Ashley Madison or Tinder or any of these other sites that I've only heard about. I've actually never been on any of these sites, so I'm probably not the best
person. Well, Ashley Madison is not up anymore, as far as I know, because
I think it shut the whole thing down, yeah.
Yeah, it has.
But, but it was designed to facilitate cheating. I mean, that was its whole purpose in existence. And so the cheating part is fairly obvious. I mean, there's all, whether it's Ashley Madison anymore or Tinder or whatever else, you can easily find new people to date and mate with. The problem is that you know, one problem is that works. Think of what that does. That works in favor of shorter-term revolving relationships. You can just have a new one, you know, every couple hours if you want, instead of the longer-term, more seriously committed relationships that, you know, old farts like me in society grew up being used to. So that, you know, that's the societal change. Then, you know, the cheating part becomes pretty obvious, and the getting caught part becomes pretty obvious. I mean, you know, now, you know, way, way too much of everybody's life's history is all on their phone, and all you got to do is hack into it, and away we go. I have a huge number of clients for whom the divorce has been triggered by exactly that. You know, I looked in your phone, and I saw what you were saying to these other girls, and I'm not impressed, and I want a divorce. So you can talk about your experiences in maybe more detail, but it's a huge issue for sure.
And underpinning all of this is, according to a recent survey, and this is very recent, 55% of Americans aged 18 to 45 spend more time with their phones than with their significant others. And that is upsetting, especially, you know, you and I, Brad, are of the generation where face-to-face communication is so important. It really is. Do you ever read Dilbert?
Oh yeah, I love that.
Yeah. So here's a Dilbert column from a while ago. And so he's walking along with Alice, who has the dark hair, and her phone is ringing. Dilbert's walking along with Alice, and the phone is ringing. She said, "I better check this," and she says, "It's just what I thought." And he says, "What did you think?" And she says, "I thought I would enjoy my phone more than talking to you." God.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Well,
that's kind of sad.
Well, it's kind of common. I mean, how many times do you walk into a restaurant and watch two people that are supposedly, you know, younger people, you know, they look like they should be on a date, and instead both of them, each of them's on their phone? I mean, they're literally sitting right across from each other at a booth in a restaurant, and both of them talking to somebody else on their phone or texting somebody else. I mean, it is really unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. And us old farts, as you put it earlier, are often shocked. Just shocked. I mean, I see it all the time, too, when my husband and I are out for dinner. And of course, we live in Seattle, which is a real high-tech place, and lots and lots of the young people work for Amazon here and Microsoft, so they're software engineers and they're very high tech, but they're on their phones and they often have difficulties in relationships. But let's get back to specifically. I've had client examples where cheating is really easier, for sure. You know, they have things like, and I haven't tried these, but they have incognito texting. Sexting, I should say. Sexting, not texting. Sexting, incognito. So now you can go on at Viber's newer feature like secret chat, which lets you schedule text combos to self-destruct after a certain amount of time. Imagine. Good heavens. And yep. Hidden chat. It requires a special PIN to access specific threads. So this makes covering suspicious tracks all too easy. And I've heard about this from clients. I don't know about these things, but it makes it easier to cover your tracks.
Well, until it's not. I mean, you know, you just read today's paper has this article about how the governor of Puerto Rico thought he was in some special chat room where he could talk to only selected few people, and he said a few negative things about a few other people, and he's now about to be impeached. I mean, you know, it's somehow everything that is supposedly protected can be accessed if you got somebody smarter trying to get into it than was the one who designed its secrecy. So it is
that's a very good point.
I wouldn't trust any of this.
No. Well, the Puerto Rican president may not get away with it, but it seems as though our president gets away with a whole lot of stuff. But that's another topic, isn't it?
He doesn't even try to make his secret. He just goes out there and fires away.
I know. It's pretty amazing. So there's also long distance everything that makes it easier for people to stray. You know, we've known about vibrators that can be controlled via smartphone, like WeVibe Sync and Kiru. Oh, my Bod Fuse.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know a lot more about this than I do, but my vibrator broke years ago, so.
So, there are all these things that are happening and that will continue to happen, like 3D printed replicas of your lover's body parts will enable with software that makes them act how you want them to. This is still in the future, but not too far away.
It's the present in Japan already. You know, Japan's a whole nother. We've talked about this before. Japan's a whole nother. Yeah. I mean, really, what tends to be happening, I mean, the marriage rate's going to drop. There's going to be a growing gap between the genders for a variety of reasons, and we've talked about that on others of your shows. And, you know, Japan is like almost a predictive example of this because, you know, Japanese women don't really want to have a lot to do with Japanese guys in a lot of the time. I'm over-exaggerating. And Japanese men have taken to having, they're designing robotic sex dolls that are, you know, right on the cusp of being the real thing in Japan, which, you know, will further widen the gap between the genders. I mean, you know, you don't have to take a robotic sex doll out to dinner. You just do whatever you want. And the more you get, and porn does the same thing. Even you know, any element of porn, way short of robotic sex dolls, tends to have the effect where you think you can do whatever you want, you know, because there's some little 18-year-old girl on your screen, or if you're, what's his name, Eisenberg or whatever his name is, the guy they just caught in New York, I guess 14-year-old girls, I don't know, but, you know,
yeah,
you can, I mean, it just,
yeah,
it tends
Eisenberg,
to foster,
yeah.
It tends to really foster a sickness as opposed to you know, healthy sexual and physical interactions. You got, you know, it can get, now porn can be, you know, I know you occasionally use it, not use it, but I mean refer to it in your practice as a sex therapist. Sometimes it can really loosen people up, and you know, and it has its, I'm sure it has its virtues, but think of all the way it's tending to give people unrealistic, what I call unrealistic sexpectations about the human body and human intercourse and I can see that being a real potentially problematic deal as well. That's one of the other things I talk about in this as another major change that's going on, this shocking mega trend, because you do have this unrealistic sexpectations where anybody with a smartphone can, you know, order up, you know, personally customized sexual desires, and, you know, how long does it take before the fantasy replaces the real human relationship? And you and I have talked before. You've got, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff coming out. This is a little disjointed, but, you know, look at the effect of Viagra. Now you've got men who have you know, maybe previously we're having a hard time performing, and probably their wife may have preferred it because, you know, we're getting older and we don't want to be having to, you know, do this all the time anyway. And now guys take that blue pill, they're immediately erect, which means that they're going to skimp even more on foreplay, which has always been one of the primary irritants for women, is having more foreplay and less, you know, immediate penetration. Now you've got guys that say, hey, you know, all I care about is my instant orgasm because I haven't had a hard-on like this in ages, and I'm going to use it, goddammit. And, you know, the gal sitting there going, are you kidding me? This is very this isn't very romantic. So there's all these little things that you know, seemingly innocuous taken independently, but you start to pile them all on together, and it's going to get harder and harder to maintain relationships. Heterosexual relationships. I think that's a trend that I'm, you know, talking about a lot when I give speeches nowadays.
Yes, and of course I see it in my practice, and it keeps me busy. But I do have some couples, and they tend to, the woman tends to be more enlightened, where there's an acceptance of pornography by both partners, and it can actually, if they both accept it and he is not doing it in secret, which is a problem, because and then she's more likely, if it's secret, it's often linked to relationship dissatisfaction, and if she sees porn use as degrading, and so degrading, and that drives them to secrecy and to couple conflicts. So, but if they both accept it, I have found that female porn use has benefits because it's a proxy for bringing partners' sexual expectations together. So I would like to hear about their experience together. Watching it. It's usually produced and directed by a woman like Erica Lust and in the past Candida Royale. But female porn use has some benefits. It can be an indicator of greater sexual knowledge, sexual openness, and communication. And there have been some studies that show that couples who view pornography together as partners find it easier to discuss their sexual desires and fantasies, and that's, of course, what I encourage. Let's stop it, even if you're watching it on a DVR. Stop it and talk about it, because communication is always the key. We're back to communication.
Well, yeah, I mean, that certainly, I think, could be a positive, and you know, I guess the question I would ask is, you know, how many couples, I mean, I know you deal with people, clients who for whom the sexual issues are becoming paramount enough that they feel compelled to come to a sex therapist, but what percentage of married couples or cohabiting couples or involved couples actually ever get that far? I would guess that it's a pretty small number, and I think it's probably a pretty small number that actually watches porn together as opposed to individually, where the guy is, you know, is perceived by the woman as a lying sack of shit just because he even watches this stuff, and you know, it really she's accused him of lack of veracity overall because he's not telling the truth about his porn viewing, and, you know, as if anybody ever really would. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is it's probably a self-selecting group of people that actually get to the point where they're evolved enough to actually look at this in a holistic way where, hey, let's do this together. Let's go see Dr. Diana together. Let's watch this video together. Yeah, I can see how that would could possibly free up all kinds of things that had gotten blocked psychologically or physiologically. But I would have to guess that that's a relatively small percentage of the couples that are evolved enough to do that. You must have a better sense of that than I do.
You're right. It is a small percentage, but I tend to get people that have been struggling with their sexuality, and some have done reading before they come to see me. And they tend to be well-educated. It's one reason I decided to specialize in sex therapy, is that people that seek sex therapy do tend to be better educated, and they really want their sex life to be better. And what I've discovered in dealing with some of these more enlightened couples is that pornography is sometimes a scapegoat for all the conversations couples aren't having, are not having.
Exactly. That's what I was trying to say, yeah.
Yeah. So men and women have very different sexual tastes. We know that. sexual preferences, sexual interests, sexual fantasies, and they're aroused by different things, and they might prefer different kinds of sexual stimulations, and all of those things occur, and for many, and so, but sometimes it does stimulate conversations if they're looking at something that can lead up to their own sex act that's hotter. And so that happens. That happens.
Well,
shall we talk?
I agree. I mean, it would certainly be good if couples could talk about, you know, about everything, their physical needs, their needs and desires and aspirations about everything in life. But I think probably both you and I would be out of business if everybody really could do that. I mean, the reality of it is that's why people get divorced. That's why people come to see sex therapists, is because, you know, they people have a really hard time talking about the difficult stuff. I know couples
true.
That, you know, just have gone for years without even mentioning to their spouse stuff that they pour out to me in the first 10 minutes of an interview. So it's just, it's weird.
Yes. So let's segue into another point in your outline, and that is living together, cohabitation, and living solo. And why don't you introduce this area for us, because there have been some changes there.
Well, you know, I think it's not just in America, but in most Western societies, there's an increasing preference for dramatically delaying marriage. I mean, getting married at much older ages than kids got married when you and I were first getting married, or to opt out of legal marriage altogether and settle for cohabitation. And there's all kinds of statistics that support that. You know, for example, in 1970, the average age for first marriages was 21 for women and 23 for men, and now it's up to 28 or even 29 for men and 26 or 27 for women. It's the oldest age for first marriages ever in American history. And many folks are just, they're not getting married, period. I mean, ever, just choosing to live together, often indefinitely. So cohabitation has become kind of the cool thing to do. You know, it used to be that maybe you tried a period of living together as a prelude to marriage, and then once you felt like you got along, you went ahead and got married. Now people are just continuing to cohabit indefinitely without ever getting married. It's huge amongst the boomers. I think you were the one who told me that that you had a term for it in your practice called living apart together, and maybe you want to talk about that, because I think that's a classic new trend where, you know, nobody needs to get married anymore. Social services that used to be available only to your spouse are now available to your significant other or your life partner or whatever you want to, you know, these new terms that you refer to your, you know, somebody who used to be a husband or wife is now just, you know, my life partner. And now they get, now they can get your retirement benefits. They can get, you know, I mean, I'm too late to this game. I remember there was a period when I'm in my 30s where I was dating an airline stewardess, and I thought, God, it would be great to be able to get her travel benefits, but the only way you could get them was if you were a spouse. Now, now travel benefits are available to your significant other. So, you know, you can get on medical plans, you can get on pensions, retirement, all this stuff that used to be available only to spouses is now available to anybody you put down as your significant other. So why bother to get married? Why bother to live with anybody if you can afford to live separately? I mean, it's a, you know, talk about your living apart together. I think that's a classic.
It's a trend, especially among those that are semi-retired or retired. And as you know, Brian and I are married, but we have the LAT, the living apart together, which really works for us. I have a home office, and we only live 20 minutes apart. We get together once a week and weekends, and we travel together. It just works very well for us. It does work well for a number of usually older couples that don't have small children. I don't think that this would work very well for people with children. But it works well for us, and there are all kinds of arrangements for couples. and you talk about it in your outline. In fact, living solo, you say, is becoming vastly more popular, and it can even rival, in some cases, cohabitation for those who can afford it. Living solo. I think that's one reason, after Charlie's death, and that was now 20 years ago. Can you believe that? Because you knew Charlie.
I love Charlie. I love Brian, too.
I know you did.
You got good taste in men, babe.
I do. Very happy about that. Makes me very happy. And with my current husband, Brian, he takes such good care of me in so many ways. Living apart together can work for some. Let's talk, because you talk about this in your outline, about from CNNMoney.com, money is the top source of marital tension. And I think that it can be that, because I know from seeing my clients, my married couples, they argue a lot about children and chores, but fights over money are more intense, and they last longer, and they're more likely to remain unresolved than fights about other topics. And I think that's because our relationship with money is deeply emotional, and that's because money both symbolizes and embodies freedom, security, and control over our lives, and it can be strongly tied to self-worth and our judgments of others. So it's charged up, the whole thing, arguments about money. And you have some statistics about that.
Well, I've got the CNNmoney.com thing, their breakdown as to the most frequent causes of couples' arguments, defined as squabbling at least once a month, and that's 41% are about money, 35% mm-hmm. are about household chores, 30% are about quality time spent together or not enough quality time spent together, 29% about raising kids, and that may be even on the low side because I think differences in parenting style, at least in my practice, seem to be a huge, huge chasm, and sometimes they fight over food and what to eat, chores. And then I guess one of the worst fights, it doesn't really rate on the statistical scale, but it rates on intensity, is snoring.
Mm-hmm.
if you're in the same bed with somebody who snores, it makes for a rough night. And that I'm sure is true. I've never been a real snorer, and I don't know that I've ever had a partner who's a real snorer. But I guess if you do, it's like listening to somebody saw logs.
There is a product that my husband uses when we sleep together. And that is Breathe Right, and it works. It's a little adhesive that goes over the bridge of the nose.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's pretty amazing how well it works. Other people get surgery or have apnea. That's dangerous, actually, and then they wear a mask. That can't be very romantic. But, yeah.
It's usually, in my case, if it's getting to be a problem, my girlfriend just sticks a sock in my mouth. Strangely enough, she does the same thing when we have sex. So I don't know. Maybe it's yeah.
You're funny, honestly, Brad. You're very funny.
Yeah,
that's good.
But it is, you know, it is tough. It is tough to live together. And again, you've got these restrictive legal and financial ties that bind in marriage. That make cohabitation a much easier choice. You know, you don't have to go see a divorce lawyer. You don't have to go talk to a judge. Somebody's getting to be a pain in the butt to live with. You just leave. And so cohabitation is huge. And the marriage rate has dropped in the U.S. by about 40% since 1970. I saw a recent statistic where here in Hawaii, it's dropped by 20% just since 2008. So in one decade, it's dropped by 20%. Meanwhile, the number of unmarried couples living together is up tenfold. So and 40% of those couples have brought kids into the relationship. I mean, that used to be another reason why you stayed married. I mean, all these social and religious and societal and economic building blocks that used to be the fortress of the modern marriage are one by one seeming to be chipped away at. I mean, you know, it used to be, you know, you had a child out of wedlock. I'm sure when you and I were, teenagers or something, a teenage pregnancy and a child out of wedlock. Oh my God, that was, you were scarred for life with that. As the woman was, and now it's, I've got the statistics that something like 40% of all kids being born today are born out of wedlock in America, and it goes up to like 50% for women under 30. So it's, you know. It's a badge of independence almost now, not a badge of dishonor. So, that's a big change too. You don't need to be married to have kids. Don't need to be married to do much of anything, as it turns out. I begin to wonder, whether you won't see a serious decline in the marriage rate going forward. It's just it's going to get. It's going to that where the slack is being picked up legally is on the paternity calendar. When you're married and have custody or child support disputes, it's part of a divorce process. When you're not married, it gets what's called the paternity calendar, and they decide same things: child custody, child support. But for unmarried couples, and that calendar has just gone through the roof, as has the domestic abuse calendar, because the other thing that tends to happen, and again, I don't want to overgeneralize here or sound like an old fogey, but the institution of marriage, where people know you socially and judge you socially about what kind of a husband or wife you are, what kind of household you run, or whether you beat your children or beat up each other or do anything, there's some strictures that go along with that. Religions frown on it. It's not cool, and it's not cool in any event anywhere. But it's without the glue that binds society together in these kind of tighter relationships. Looser relationships promote looser behavior, and you scream and fight and swear and hit each other, and turn around and leave the house, and nobody stops you because there's, like I say, and you do all that kind of crazy stuff in a marriage, and you got to go to divorce court, you got to pay expensive lawyers, you got to officially get out of the marriage, something, and now you just turn and walk, and sometimes
and walk.
What
you didn't mention is emotional abuse, and that occurs just so often, and it can be. Oh, one partner can just be pounding the other with particular issues, and to be that you're always passive aggressive, and you're always childish, and you're always this or you're always that. You don't want to have sex with me. It's I try to encourage my clients to not say never or always. But so many times they just need to talk to each other, but there are these barriers, and some of the barriers have to do with fear. Maybe fears of abandonment, or, the woman might not want to be left alone because she'd been left alone as a kid. And I'm simplifying things here, but it's true.
Well,
yeah.
Should we talk
about... gray divorce in the time we have left?
Yeah, since we're both gray, I guess, yeah.
Cover my gray up, for sure.
There we go.
I've been a blonde for too many years. I can't. That's how I see myself. And
you'll always be a blonde to me.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, it's gray divorces are, that's the cutesy term of art that applies to people getting divorced at older ages in life, and it's always been presumed that longer marriages were generally expected to be more stable. But nowadays, this is a striking statistic: 25% of all recent divorces involve people who've been married for two decades or more. So that's the least likely. I mean, you always hear about the 7-year itch where you know, kids get married too young and they have a kid and it's difficult to raise a kid and money's an issue and, you know, yada, 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 all those different causes that I talk about in some of my speeches. And the 7-year itch is traceable, and Helen Fisher and Margaret Mead and others were the first to start talking about that, as you mentioned. But you'd think that once you got past your 7 years of marriage, 15 years of marriage, 20 years of marriage, you know, that things would begin to stabilize. But now, surprisingly enough, one in every four Americans who gets divorced is a gray-haired guy or gal over age 50. And that's compared to, like, fewer than one in 10 as recently as 1990. So it is, it's really, that number has really, really spiked. And, in fact, the number of divorces for folks over 50 has doubled within that last 20 years. So you've got now a situation where a lot of aging baby boomers are already on their second marriages, and I've mentioned in my earlier shows with you that second marriages are statistically more risky than first marriages. I'll just, as an aside for anybody that may be a new listener, you always hear about the divorce rate being about 50% of all marriages, but actually it's only about 45% of first marriages, 65% of second marriages, and fully 85% of third marriages. It spikes up exponentially, mainly because people just get, you know, used to having more options. I mean, that's a lot of what we're really talking about today is, you know, it's great to have all these different options, but as you put it, as Helen Fisher puts it, you know, it can almost lead to cognitive overload. You know, yeah, I've had a pretty good wife for all these years, but, you know, I've got another 10 or 15 years left, and, you know, maybe it's time for a new wife or a new husband or whatever. And, you know, it's almost like too many choices can become kind of a bad thing. I'm exaggerating, but you get my point.
I do get your point, and I think that's often true. You say in your writing that Stephanie Kuntz, and she is well known as a marriage expert, she's a professor here in Washington State, she calls it thicker remarriage markets, that there are just all these options now, potential new partners out there, and the expectations. And if you've lived with somebody for 30, 40 years, and it just seems like it's not going to work out, maybe you've tried, maybe you've had therapy, maybe it's been too little too late. But sometimes the idea of having a new partner is refreshing, and it can really
especially with
too.
You know, with these longer, you know, if you're 65 today, you statistically you've got another 20 years to live, and you know, so you have these longer life expectancies. It just seems like, you know, there's more, and you know, you're living a healthier lifestyle. You know, you've got more options available. I mean, a lot of this has to do with this exponentially expanding number of options. I mean, when you think about, you know, Stephanie Kuntz calls it a thicker remarriage market when in her talk about boomers. But when you think about it, if you're an 18-year-old living in a town in, you know, Nebraska, and you've got your high school girlfriend, and she's pretty cute, and she's the cheerleader, and you're the captain of the football team, you know, the tendency may be to say, I mean, again, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, I'm never going to find anybody like her. You know, there's no other girls in this Nebraska town that even come close. I better marry her. You know, I mean, that was your choice. I don't know how many marriages were based on that in the old days, but probably a lot of them were just, this is the best I'm going to do. I better just take option A. And now there's options A through Z. And not only does it happen when you're in high school or college or midway through your life, it happens now when you're 65. You go, well, geez, I deserve better. I think a lot of people don't even know what they think they're going to get out of this deal or why they think they deserve something better. But they all are, you know, a lot of people are just thinking that, you know, we've all gotten so spoiled. You know, life's got to have something better in store for me. And now you just go online and you think, oh, yeah, maybe this new gal, she looks kind of cute. I think I'll call her and make her one out of the 5 to 9 people that I meet this next month, and you know, you're off and running again. So it is really an interesting phenomenon to watch baby boomers divorcing at literally twice the rate of previous generations, which would have been unheard of, you know, even 10 years ago.
That's right. Yeah, it has to do with options and expectations. Well, let's put expectations. Well, they're together, options and expectations. You do have so many more options with the Internet, and thus the expectations are higher. Why should I stay in this marriage of 30, 35 years when I could potentially meet... I mean, I'm seeing a 68-year-old woman who is married from her early 20s, and so a long time. Long time married. They were both virgins when they got married, and her husband had an affair with a woman, and he kept it a secret even in counseling. I was not the counselor because I usually uncover these things. But so the husband lied during the counseling, and so this woman is really feeling kind of stranded because she's unfamiliar with the dating scene. This is true. So I'm giving her lots of skills that she can perhaps use to write a good profile and to navigate the online dating scene with eHarmony. For older people, it's often eHarmony and Match.com, and Our Time is another one for older people. But it can be hard when you've been used to one person for 40 years.
Yeah, that's for sure. And
it's scary.
You know, it's like I say, we're marching ahead as a society without any real roadmap as to where all this leads. I mean, marriage historically has been viewed as being a stabilizing factor for society in general. Families that were raised with two-parent households generated more stable kids. Nuclear families were a good thing. You know, that's always been, and the mantra that we all grew up with. Well, now, all that is sort of, just being sort of brazenly brushed aside, and, it's okay for, a woman to have, kids out of wedlock, or, how about two kids by two different guys? But there's statistics that indicate that every time a new partner marches in and out of a woman's life, there's a 12% increase in the neuroses of the kids. So we all want to see all this liberation take place, and I know this is the progressive radio network, everything should be happy-go-lucky for everybody, and, I've been a headlong baby boomer hedonist for way too long, and, the boomers are roundly criticized for being too materialistic and self-centered, and they probably are, but we are in a situation where thrusting aside of all the conventional institutions, we don't really know exactly what's going to replace them. And that, to me, is that's going to be probably what my next book is about. I mean, it really is interesting because it's like when everybody was smoking cigarettes before we had a Surgeon General report that says, hey, smoking is going to cause lung cancer. Who knows what all these different lifestyles and arrangements are going to do in American society or Western societies going forward, 30 years from now, when you've got all these kids from all these different relationships, maybe it's going to work out just fine.
And maybe there'll be additional problems. Brad, they're about to cut in with the music, so that means the end of the show. I just want to thank you for another great show, Brad. And we're going to have part two with you September the
24th. September 24th.
Yeah.
September the 24th, so then, I think, is what we're shooting for.
Right. And we'll
that's
do that.
And we're going to be talking again about more of this, about the, literally we'll focus more on the, the future of America's families as a result of all some of these. We're trying to predict the future as to where all this may lead. And that would be an interesting part, too, to some of the stuff, the trends we've discussed. So I love being on. Best aloha to all your listeners, and thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, and I don't hear the music, so we can chat a little bit longer, but I just didn't want to be cut off before a proper goodbye to you and gratitude to you. You're always a fascinating guest with lots to say. And
knowing you, you'll make your own music anyway, so yeah, we'll talk again on the 24th, and again, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Brad. Bye, everybody.
Cosa leggerai con calibro affascini il tuo cuore? E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un...